Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. This is John Marchando, and this is part of the Two Guys in a PLC podcast. I am joined by my partner in crime,
Dave Gutshaw. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Yes, welcome to another wonderful episode. Just a reminder for all of you out there, this is for entertainment purposes only, and all opinions expressed are our own and are not reflective of our day jobs, our employers, our spouses, partners, old flames, just our own.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thank you. Man, we have an awesome guest today, don't we, John? My gosh. I can't actually believe he's
absolutely
here.
Absolutely, man. I mean, when you suggested this, I'm thinking to myself, do you think he'll actually say yes?
Yeah.
You reached out to him, and sure enough,
I'm
here we are.
I'm telling you what. So, yeah. So let's introduce our guest, Mr. Albert Mitchell. Tell us about
yourselves. Nice to be here.
So freaking glad, Albert. You know, when I look back on my career using Cisco products, I still get giddy when I think back to kind of my first days with the first kind of device that I ever touched. I think it was a 2500, and it had a token ring side and a 10 megabit Ethernet side. And to be talking to someone with so much history, I'm not even sure what to say. So we kick it off with a question, and that is, so you've been on the industrial IoT side inside of Cisco for what, a decade or more?
Yeah.
About
that? A little
more.
But
you've been around a lot longer. So maybe talk about kind of those early days a little bit and what that sort of journey was into the, you know, like what got us even thinking about going over to the ruggedized side? Because, you know, I remember that 2955, that was the first kind of ruggedized piece of gear that Cisco made that I ever touched.
Yeah, what brought you to the dark side, I guess, is the question, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to say one thing, Dave, as far as my appearance fee, that the check... I'm a little suspicious now.
You're breaking up. Hello?
Yeah. Your signal's breaking up.
Yeah. So the 2955 was last year we announced it hit its 20th anniversary of the 2955, which I think is Cisco's first foray into the industrial world. So that was back in, so I was actually working as a software engineer in the business unit that developed what was the Catalyst 2500, and the Catalyst 2400, and so one of our customers one of our Catalyst desktop switching customers approached us and just said, hey, if you build it, we'll buy it, and that just sort of kicked it off. There was a market opportunity for us to expand the beyond sort of enterprise type deployments where you have air conditioning into, all right, let's just take the same technology and build it so you don't need fans. And so you can meet vibration specifications and temperature specifications and you go fanless and we'll sell it. And at that time there wasn't enough competition. And so it actually did fairly well. I mean, it looks a lot different than what we have today in terms of, you know, DIN rail mounted Ethernet switches. But that's really just somebody approached us with the market opportunity. And when we look at like what was the cost to develop it, it was like, okay, let's take the same technology that we have in our enterprise, 19-inch rack mount pizza box, shrink it, put it just the fundamental portions of it, and put it into, a cube that doesn't need fans and can cool itself. And that's just how it all started.
That's wild. So, I mean, we didn't have the So Cisco didn't have the competencies yet, though, right? Like, meaning every piece of engineering that was being done was about, okay, the thermals look different when I'm inside of an enclosure with moving air. I can pass air across these fins of these heat sinks. And, you know, the ambient in the room is probably going to be, you know, hopefully not over 70 degrees Fahrenheit. And you literally were going to a new drawing board there, right? There was no precedent for, hey, we're going to throw this into a small enclosure and there's not going to be any fan at all.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So the whole figuring out how to do the thermals, to me, that's an unspoken of strength or skill that you just have to have in your hardware mechanical team. They just have to understand what the regulations are, how to cool things, and how to understand and meet thermal dynamic requirements. And it's not trivial, because you can get, I don't use the term lazy, you can get lazy and just make it big, right? If you increase surface area, you increase essentially the shell for which you can dissipate heat. And that's the sort of the lazy way out of building something like this. So the key is make it as small as possible, because the enclosures are not getting larger, right? They're getting smaller. That's right. Or if anything, they expect...
And enclosure space is expensive, so...
And if anything, they expect the size to at least remain the same as the technology advances, right? So we went from fast Ethernet to gigabit, but the size of the cube of the Ethernet switch can't change, even though it's putting off more heat. So that's always been the cool thing. And I think for me, I remember I was working as a software engineer at the time in the business unit that developed it, but I actually didn't work on it. The guy that was sitting in the cube next to me was actually like the main software engineer, and he was looking at this thing and showing it to me, and I'm like, this is the funkiest piece of equipment I've ever seen. How do you power this thing? Where's the power cord go? And he was talking to me about DC power and things like that. And this was, you know, back in, 2004. Little did I know, 10 years later or so, I'd actually be working in the business unit that's whose primary goal is to sell those things. So a bit of a forecasting of my career in some respects.
Right.
Yeah. And right. You take me back to, cause I've been doing this for over 30 years. So that just tells you how long, how old I am. And I won't reveal that here, but I told Albert before we started, my age and what was going on with me. But, I go back to the days when they were still using AC power in the panel for PLCs and logic. And now they don't do any of that. I mean, it's all DC, it's all 24 volt, but I can remember back on the automotive plant floors in the early 90s, where they were using AC in the panels. It was just crazy.
Yeah.
How unsafe that was.
Yeah. And what's funny is my memory of that 2955 was we were trying to extend Ethernet into a pump house, I think, pump room, pump house. And the problem was that there was no place to land a new IDF. So there was just, logistics wise, there was no floor space. There was no way to get up into the building columns around in the area. There was no nice, clean place to put it. And so we got this crazy idea we'll just throw an access switch somewhere, mount it, give us another 100 meters kind of thing. And it was like right about that time, it was released. We took one look at it and went, oh my gosh, this is actually designed to be out there, not inside an enclosure, not cooled, because every other IDF we had at the time was, of course, HVAC controlled. And so part of this was, I don't have room for a cabinet. I don't have room to mount something. And it was great.
Well, Albert, there were people doing industrial switches before Cisco got into the business, right? There were a lot of competitors out there. Talk a little bit about that and how we broke into the space and got to the position we're in now.
You put me on the spot, John. I was actually in the software department back then. And since I wasn't on this project, I don't have a ton of understanding about what the business case was or the business environment was for industrial switching back then. So I can't really speak too much to what the competitors were doing. Sorry about that.
No, somebody had to have seen an opportunity there, though, because if you make one business case, we put an entire group together, or at least we started in 2004, right? And it's grown to what it is today. That's pretty compelling, apparently.
But I think like anything, somebody came to us and basically a customer or maybe a group of customers could have been like water utilities or substation automation companies or something that says, look, if you build this, I'll buy it, right? We rarely take something like we're just you have to realize back in 2004, just like it is today, like Ethernet switching is a big business for Cisco. And so we're not just gonna like willy-nilly just build something for which and say, let's build it and see if we can sell it. No, right? We're turning down so many business opportunities that we pretty much only build something if we know we're going to sell it because somebody's asking for it and they're willing to write a check to cover the cost of development. So we don't do something on speculation, right? So I suspect that there was a customer or a group of customers that had already been lined up for us to do this so that we knew we were going to at least recover the cost of the development team and then get into profitability within a couple of years. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have done it. So I want to say we could have been we were partnering with Rockwell at the time or somebody like that who's like really gave us a big I'll say like if we'll partner with you if you build this we'll resell it and something like some other opportunity. That's how it had to have happened. But I wasn't on the project, so I don't have the details for the original 2950.
Was thinking back to the year and the sequence, is that it's interesting that that came out in 04, and then the first version of any kind of validated design or similar for industry was about what, 3 years later, maybe four? Wasn't Ethernet to the factory floor? Wasn't that 07, 08, Albert?
Yeah, but there was a joint venture before that with GE and Cisco, right? Before the Rockwell thing.
Ooh, you got me. I don't know.
Yeah, I believe there was. I spent some time at GE Fannuc, and I have some guys that moved on because GE Fannuc no longer exists. And there was a joint venture between Cisco and GE at one point to take this into the factory floor, but I don't think it went anywhere. Obviously, it didn't go anywhere
Yeah.
because we're now
Yeah,
doing things with
interesting.
Rockwell. But yeah, there was something there.
Man, I want to dig up the history of that at some point, John. That'd be great to. It's a hole in my historical record, so to speak.
Yeah, and
What had
don't
happened
ask me
right
how I
before
pulled that
that?
out of my
Oh, that's okay. No,
memory bank there, but
that's great. So Albert, when you were so got it. You kind of got exposed early on the software team, right? 2955. You saw this sort of sales ramp. Again, CVD, then along came the kind of the partnership with Rockwell. At some point here in the, 5 years later, roughly, you actually joined that business unit. But what were you working on in between there that kind of got you to moving over to the industrial business unit at the time?
So in between the launch of the 2955, I stayed on as a software engineer. And then for my personal career, I did 1 year of customer escalation. So when customers had a problem, you have to recreate it and, figure out if there's a software solution or if it's an issue, actual hardware issue or software issue, then you sort of take it back to the development team and you explain to them what it is. So it's like things escalate past the technical support that you would normally get up to the business unit. So I was doing that for a year. And then I moved over to become a technical marketing engineer. So then I went over to the Catalyst product management team. So now it's the 3750, about to become 3850 team, where we're starting to do stacking of 3750s, 3560s. And now I joined as a technical marketing engineer there. So I got out of software development. This is like internal Cisco stuff. I got out of the software team. And I joined a different team. I migrated over to product management, and that was about, yeah, that was about 2008 or 2009 or so. So I moved over to product management. I've sort of never looked back. I've been in product management TME ever since for Catalyst. So I did the sort of the same. So then I got sort of disconnected from the industrial switch and for a little bit. But otherwise, as a, but now the industrial switch. So now I see the industrial switch Now it's the IE 3000, right? So they made another version of it to sort of address customer needs, the IE 3000. And now I'm seeing it as a technical marketing engineer that, you know, we have it's now in the product management group, and we're trying to now position that and sell it with the sales teams. So this is going in sort of like towards 2009, 2010 or so. And what I see is the partnership with Rockwell is now starting. And I think that's what really drove for the IE switching really took it up a notch. Like once we had Rockwell on board and you know, we had like the Ethernet to the factory, like you mentioned earlier, that validated design that we worked on with Rockwell. We put Ethernet switching in there and the partnership with Rockwell, that really took the business up a notch. That's really what sort of catapulted it, I think, to making it a really big business for Cisco and something that we wanted to continue to invest in.
Now, did you have to make a lot of changes to the product when you started having that relationship with Rockwell, or was there was it a pretty easy transition?
So, well, Rockwell took what we had, but they said, this is great, but what we need
there's always a but.
We need more fiber, we need smaller, we need bigger. So remember the IE 2000, I think, this is all for entertainment purposes, but
yes,
essentially,
right.
the whole list of all the product IDs that you could get for the IE 2000, because remember, like they were like 10 to 15 different product IDs, different sizes, they did different things. That was Rockwell saying, we need this many SKUs. We'd have all these different little market segments that we want to sell into for our customers that have all these minute detailed requirements that you can't have with just one big switch. So that was the sort of the SKU proliferation, was Rockwell driving the PRD for the next version of industrial switch after the IE 3000. So that became the IE 2000. And for Rockwell, it became the Stratix 5700, I want to say. 5700, 5800. Anyway, that's Rockwell really. So you want to talk about the business and the relationship that we had with Rockwell. Is they literally, I mean, they pretty much wrote the PRD for the third generation industrial switch, which for Cisco was the IE.
Yeah, okay. Got it. It's interesting that, so the first version of that Stratix that I had gotten my grubby mitts on at the time was the 8000, which was the 3K for, to your point,
right,
the IE 3000. It was, that actually was, I probably would never have come to Cisco if it weren't for the 3000, the IE3K, because we were in the, you know, this is like, again, entertainment purposes only. We were in the early days of discussing factory transformation. And I'll never forget, I walked into kind of this, I think it was called the Automated Controls Best Practice Circle, if I remember right. And
that sounds like a big name.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy, right? Too many acronyms. See, not just Cisco does crazy acronyms. And the, you know, you've got this room full of maintenance folks and controls folks and, you know, everybody but IT. And here I am, the, you know, I'll say the wet behind the ears IT guy walking into the room with a switch. But thankfully, it didn't look like an IT switch. It looked like, like, wait, the color matches the controllers that we've got. And suddenly that defanged the naysayers. The fact that it looked and was colored like a Rockwell controller is what all of their dander went down. They're like, oh, that's interesting. Oh, look at that.
Honestly, it fits right beside the PLC. Look at that. It's the right size.
Yeah. It was crazy how all of the, I mean, look, there were certainly naysayers, but it defanged and risked and de-escalated. If I would have brought the IE3K into that room, the exact same product that was colored like all of the IT switches, they would have run me out of the room.
They literally were judging the switch by its color.
Yep. They literally were judging the switch by its
and
color.
And size to some extent, I'm sure, right?
Sure. Yeah. To your point, John, it fit right. Like they could look at it and tell that it fit nicely right next to that controller.
Look like a slick 500, except maybe smaller, right?
Yeah.
But nobody's looking at technical specifications.
No.
Yeah, there you go.
No, that's exactly it. Not at that point, right? So, yeah, I think the other thing that's interesting when you talked about the timeline is that feels like it happened maybe later than I was thinking from a, because I was thinking internally internally just from a Cisco lens, that the business unit really took off between 04 and 07. And it almost sounds like it really took off between 07 and 10.
Yeah. So you have to realize, but in between, so when the IE 3000 came out and the IE 2000 came out, there was also, there was two business opportunities. One was to keep building, like from Cisco's perspective, when we're looking at the business, you can keep building switches for manufacturing, but you needed a different switch with different requirements, quote unquote, for the utility sector. So we actually split the businesses. There was a smart grid business unit that we created for a while, and they built their own products. So for a while, we had the IE 2000, which was, for Cisco's purposes, intended for manufacturing. And then we had the IE 2000U, which stood for utilities, that was built by Smart Grid, a different business unit working for utilities. And we also had the CGS, the Connected Grid Switch 2500, which was a 19-inch rack mount, still fanless, but 19-inch rack mount, and the Industrial Ethernet 3010, which was also now a 19-inch rack mount, fanless industrial switch. The hardware was very similar, but the software was different. So the business units actually shared like a hardware engineering team, built two different products sort of based off very similar hardware architectures, and then put different software on them and had different software teams. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. That's wild. But they were still all traditional iOS at the time though, right?
Yeah. It was still running iOS, but they had different teams building the hardware and the software and the support and product management and the whole thing. We were completely different. They had the Smart Grid business unit. I remember when that happened. So I want to say that was, somebody's going to listen to this and get the dates and say, yeah, you got the dates all wrong. But I want to say 2011, maybe.
Okay.
That's when that split off. And then I think right about 2013, 2014 timeframe, they came back together. At this point now, the industrial team had split off. So I think there was for a long time, the industrial switch, like especially when this IA 3000 was all part of Catalyst, from a engineering, marketing, product management domain organization. It was just one more product within all of the Catalyst's product switching. So the industrial switching, the IoT group within Cisco had split off. And then that's when it joined with the Connected Grid. So the Connected Grid and the industrial switching team rejoined and formed their own business unit again.
Is that when Vikas was involved?
Yes. So Vikas comes in. So Vikas is now like a VP, but he was the director at that point. And he joined shortly after the organizations had re-come back together again in their own business unit to form IoT.
Gotcha.
So for a while there, we had product management. So now product management, I'm in the product management group, so I'm speaking mostly from that perspective. So now product management, we're managing, you know, the 2000 and the 2000U. And that's interesting because unless you look really close, they're the exact same hardware, the same color, same hardware. You got to look in the top right corner to see, oh, this one has the U. That's why you can't use the SD card on it, because it's, you know, you can't take the SD card out of the U and plug it into your laptop and look at the Mac 32, because that has a different file system on the 2000U for your SD card. Like, things like that were popping up all the time, right? Unless you look really closely, you wouldn't notice the difference between a 2000U, because they had the same hardware team.
Right. So, and this was one for Smart Grid, one for other industrial. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some wild history there. I had no, somehow, right, you learn a lot when you're inside the four walls, but the history lessons just didn't, you didn't hear a lot of that. So that, man, that fills in some huge gaps. when the joining kind of the, right, the, it sounds like they were together and then they split and then they came back together again. In each one of those cases, that was no, those entities were no longer part of the traditional cat business unit at that point, right? They were their own, essentially their own entities. Is that right?
Yeah, their own business. Exactly. Yeah.
Right, own business. So as we think of like an architecture, it was its own architecture essentially inside.
Yeah, its own P&L.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's P&L, exactly. Its own P&L, if you want to talk about it from a business perspective, right?
Yeah.
So it,
yeah, well put.
Yeah, it was separate, just like WebEx is separate from Cisco. I mean, it's got its own business unit. You know, the firewall team has their own business unit. Security does. And so industrial switching was its own business. Or industrial networking.
So Albert, what challenges did you guys run into when you were trying to, and you may not be able to talk directly to this, but you know, you had to develop a whole new channel and route to market for this whole thing. What kind of challenges did you run into?
The biggest challenge was getting the Cisco sales team to focus on this and look for the opportunities. At this point, the biggest challenge we had originally was just the generalist sales teams were just selling their data center, industrial switching, or not the industrial, but the enterprise switching rather, data center, security, wireless. They were selling their normal stuff. And so to get them to also sell and look for opportunities for industrial was tough. I mean, yeah, we had a few customers, a few of the big customers, like you can think like the Fortune 500 companies that are sort of centered on manufacturing. Yeah, they were buying it, but we were having a hard time getting that next tier down. And remember, we were trying to get partners on board. Man, we were trying really hard to get another partner from Rockwell or to get resellers to sign up, right, and stop selling the competition, sort of Hirschman and Moxa and Siemens, and start selling Cisco. That was the struggle that I don't think we ever really got very far with that. So that was really the big struggle, was getting Cisco sales teams to focus on it and getting partners to come on board and sort of break their relationships that they had with the existing or the Cisco's competitors, like Hirschman, Siemens, Moxa, and start putting Cisco on the price list. So that was the big challenge.
Yeah, I mean, the you know, this is classic challenge with the internal teams, right? Because generally speaking, their buying centers, their customers, the folks they're talking to, they kind of look the same from one customer to the other, just generally speaking, almost regardless of vertical.
Well, purchasing, it all goes up through the same purchasing department typically.
Right.
So,
right. Whereas as soon as you flip to the industrial side, well, now you're talking to lines of business. You're talking to folks that, you know, they look potentially, they look drastically different between verticals. And number one, the account team isn't necessarily used to talking to them. Number two, to your point, the path of least resistance is let me keep doing the motion that I know and that I'm comfortable with. And I'd argue that problem still exists for you know, some places.
Well, in some cases, it is the same purchasing organization. No matter if you're in talking IT or you're talking, or you know, the OT, the plant floor, it may go up through the same procurement group.
Yeah, for sure. Albert, I want to pivot a little bit to maybe some other historical topics and just get an understanding of maybe what you knew or know or what have you. When I first joined Cisco, I had talked to a gentleman by the name of Roy Osterberg, and my recollection was that he was on the original engineering team that actually had started with, I think, the 5000, like the first large chassis-based cat.
Okay.
How much overlap, if any, were there between kind of those original cat engineering teams and those original ruggedization engineering teams? It feels like if it weren't for some of those historical folks inside of those original legacy business unit, like a lot of the products that we have today just wouldn't have happened.
Oh, yeah. Roy Osterberg, that's a name. That's a blast in the past. Roy was quite the character. I remember I met Roy a lot when I was working as a TME in the product management group for sort of the Catalyst 3750, 3850 families. And Roy at the time was running the solution engineering team for enterprise deployment. So not just switching, but, you know, routing, switching, wireless for enterprise deployments. And whenever you went to talk to Roy and you had a question or you wanted, you know, to see something he or he was testing or some sort of solution, you had to make sure that you had an hour because Roy was going to talk to you about everything. Roy just liked to talk and tell stories. I mean, he was quite knowledgeable. He had a huge history about how things were done and why we got to where we got. But anyway, the funny thing is I remember like, oh man, if you go talk to Roy, you got to make sure you have an hour.
I love people like that, though, because you learn so much about what's going on or has gone on at the company.
So it's just one of those things. Like, I mean, without fail, unless Roy was really, really busy, which, I mean, he was, but he always had time to sit down and tell stories. Yeah, so Roy was so he came in. So now we're going to go way back in Cisco's engineering acquisitions. So Cisco essentially acquired three Ethernet switching companies. I forget the names of all of them, but one of them essentially turned out to be what was the large chassis, which is the 5000, eventually became the 6000 and the 6500, which was sort of Cisco's frontline Ethernet switch. That was the big switch. Then there was a medium-sized one that we had that was more focused on large-scale wiring closet, which was the Catalyst 4000, then became the Catalyst 4500. Again, this is a chassis mount system. And then the third one they bought became the Catalyst 2940, 2950, then became the 3750 and the 3850. It's now the Catalyst 9300, but it's the pizza box, right? The single, the one rack box. So Cisco actually had three different switching companies. They were all running different operating systems at the time. Remember, like Catalyst, I mean, originally the 6500 was running CatOS.
Yep.
And you can when you search for stuff, sometimes you still get CatOS comes up. I'm sure it's still running out there in a wide number of places. I mean, it was a great product.
766.
It was the most stable CatOS code I ever ran.
There you go.
You got me, man. Nope. Right over my head there.
Yeah.
Right over my head. I'm a controls guy. I'm right over my head.
I remember those days. I resisted the switch. I wanted, for the longest time, I wanted nothing to do with unified iOS across the 65s. We tried it a couple times in the lab, and it just was not stability, if I remember, wasn't there right away. And so we ran one version of iOS on the MSFC and another version of Cat for all the layer 2 stuff for a long time.
Dude, anytime you say the word unified means it's not. I mean, unfortunately, that's like air gap. When you say air gap,
yeah, right.
It's really not air gap. Really right? Not. So.
I'm sorry, I interluded there with the CatOS version.
No, you got Roy Osterberg. So Roy worked. So he came in. I either came in on the acquisition of the company that was building the Catalyst 6500, what became the Catalyst 6500, and so he was always sort of oriented towards big deployments, data centers, and those kinds of things where you put the Catalyst 6500. I don't know why did you asked me about Roy Osterberg and I went off on like the history of Cisco's.
This is great.
No, that was great. Yeah, I just, it's funny for two reasons. One, because I remember him the same way, is that, man, such a character. And any time you'd ask him a question, he would just download so much data. Like, I wish I could, wish I would have had a recorder along. I could play those suckers back, right? But the history of, like, when he had started touching that original 5000 chassis dawned on me that, you know, there was a lot of early engineering help that were probably key to eventually breaking off and you know, again, developing those initial business units, both for, you know, utilities and, would you say, smart grid, or I think it was smart grid you said. I was thinking, you know, at the same time, right, there, to your point, Albert, earlier about the here's a market, you see some competitors in it, they're doing something, you know, that potentially Cisco could get a piece of the pie of. But we know engineering from a standpoint of traditional IT spaces, IT protocols, IT capabilities. It just feels like such a pivot to suddenly being able to do all of these other things that, you know, even today, there are scenarios when we release a new product where, you know, you throw it in a larger manufacturing plant or similar, and you've got a whole bunch of corner case legacy devices that suddenly don't behave on the sucker because, you know, even our well-documented, well-traveled testing procedures aren't catching it because, again, they're corner cases. So I just, yeah. I can just imagine the hill to climb at that point was just so big back then when we made those decisions.
And for me, I'm 5 years in with Cisco, you know, as part of the Fluid Mesh acquisition. So I'm still wet behind the ears as far as the internal Cisco stuff goes. So I love these conversations because I learn a lot. Every time we do one of these little more focused podcasts on Cisco, I really, really enjoy and learn a lot. But the question I was going to ask was, how did you two get to know each other? Where did you first meet up?
Oh my goodness, that's a great question.
Seems like we've been working together a long time.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm so bad with like the initial. I mean, Albert, I'll give you my first couple year history and maybe that'll explain where we crossed paths first. So I came in under Brian Tanzen at the time in IVSG. So I was in the business unit as a BDM, focusing on solutions, taking something from Cisco, something from a partner, smushing it together, testing it at a customer, and then seeing whether or not we can productize it. I didn't move to sales until after like 16. And then I was part of the digital transformation team as a practice advisor for a bit till that blew up. And then I went over to, at the time, it was our industrial, I'm sorry, no, it was our IoT software team, software only, with the term that must not be named that started with a K.
I actually know what that is. I'll
yeah,
show that.
Yeah, oh my gosh. That's a podcast in of itself. but Albert, I'm thinking it was while I was on Brian's team in either 15 or 16 that we first crossed paths.
Okay, that could very well be because I was full on as the product TME then for industrial switches at that point. And I was just starting to get into all the solutions that we had for anytime we're putting an Ethernet switch in a solution, which should be every solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And now as I'm thinking, memory's jogging, it was probably at one of the first. So we used to have in-person Rockwell Cisco CBD discussions where we basically meet around a table. Somebody would own the tracking document as to what's coming up and being changed, what's coming down the docket next. I want to say you were probably in one of those rooms with Paul Didier the first time I met you.
Could very well be.
I bet that's the case. And if it, for some reason it wasn't those, then it was at some point when I probably did a presentation in San Jose and you were one of the distinguished speakers.
Yeah, there's not going to be probably an exact moment. It probably was going to be one of those like larger meetings. There was lots of people there, lots of new faces, both for me at the time, you know, for Cisco and like Rockwell or sales organizations. But just sort of slowly but surely. But I think when we really started working together is I think once you went over to sales, I think that's when we really started collaborating a lot more on customer problems.
Yep.
And products and how are we getting it out there? And I think that's when I realized when it comes to manufacturing, Gutshall really knows what's going on. You can tell he's got all this experience. I'm like, okay, he's going to be an asset that I can use here when we need to start, you know, having questions that are related to manufacturing and I need to get somebody's opinion. So we may have met, but once you made the move to sales and you were kind of focused, you did a lot of focusing on manufacturing. Okay, Gutshall really understands what's going on.
I thank you.
Dave
for
doesn't
the...
have any opinions. He yeah. doesn't have any opinions at all.
All right. No. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Sometimes my opinion gets ahead of me. That's for sure as heck. Good, bad, or ugly, right? Thank you for the compliments, Albert. There's 9 minutes left here, and I was going to turn it back on you and say that you know you're on this sort of you know potential off ramp or whatever you want to call it, and you know, as you can imagine, all I see is all this history walking out the door and the competency. And, you know, look, you can teach a lot of people a lot of things, and people can learn skills and learn techniques and get good at something, get great at something. All of that training, all of that technique, all of that knowledge, it doesn't also educate on the history, the why, what happened, why we do what we did back then. All of those kinds of things are going to walk out the door when you finally hang up your Ethernet cable. And we are going to be lesser because of it. And I'm hoping that your off-ramp is short.
Anytime I hear your name in conversation, Albert, and this is not a trivial thing at all. Every time I hear your name, people are very complimentary of you, and I really don't know you very well at all. We've swapped messages on WebEx several times, but you know I haven't been involved with you like Dave has. But I hear nothing but just glowing things about you and your character and your knowledge of not only Ethernet but just of the business in general. So it's been great sharing some airtime with you.
The man is an institution.
All right. You guys are making me blush.
Well,
well you never know
the
video's off. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's good stuff.
I often heard that the people always say that I have a great voice for, I have a great face for radio.
Great
so
face
it's perfect.
For radio.
Yeah. great that we're on, or there's no video. People are going to find it much more enjoyable just to listen to us.
They could be. Yeah, I'm with you. I want nothing to do with the video side of things. That may change one day when we do this, but it's definitely less stressful to not have to worry about it. My voice is bad enough. I don't want to couple my face with it. Ugh. Harsh.
So I got a question for you, Albert. Sure. As we kind of get closer to wrapping here, what kind of advice can you give us to make sure that we are, you know, successful and are able to move the ball forward, you know, not just within Cisco, but just, you know, from what you've learned in your time in industry, you know, what can you kind of leave us and people that are listening to reflect on and focus on to be successful?
Sure. The first thing that sort of comes to mind is what I've been learning about product management and sales for a long time. And one of my old bosses talked to me about this, and they called it blocking and tackling. It's like the fundamentals. So when we go out on sales and we come out with marketing, we always want to market and advertise the shiny new thing, some new feature, some technology. And that's great. We have to show the innovation. But I mean, if you don't understand the fundamentals, like if you're talking about using football as an analogy, you can have the shiny new quarterback, right? But if you can't block and tackle, you can't win any football games. So I always think like it's always the fundamentals. You can't lose track of the fundamentals. Not everybody wants that shiny new thing, that new feature, that new technology. They still just need, you know, I still need 100 megabits, right? Full duplex and make it work with Spanning Tree with these different vendors. And as an example, like they just need the fundamentals. And I think don't get too far away from understanding that most customers need the fundamentals to just sort of work. And that's what I find that I kept coming back to. You know, I had to participate in a lot of, we had to advertise and talk about the shiny new thing, and that's great. And I like doing that too. I like innovating and building new things. But from sustained success, the fundamentals just always have to be there. And that comes to like product quality, both hardware and software. So maintain product quality in hardware and software, as well as show the ability to innovate and push the needle forward. So you can always see a value in, you know, working with Cisco and Cisco's products. I think that blocking and tackling is what I would remind everybody to just stay true to the fundamentals. Right?
Back to basics.
Yeah. Back to basics. Yeah. Great advice. Yeah. Thank you for that. I think that's the old, you know, sometimes we miss the, you know, that forest for the trees, right? We're so focused on where we're going and what the next step is and what customers are going to want 3 years from now. And so let's you know, think about the next innovation that's going to get everybody excited, when, you know, it's still fundamentally about a last mile connection that everybody knows, that understands, compatibility with everything that's out there at a form factor and speed with security capabilities and layer two convergence capabilities that people can trust.
That's it. Yeah. And Hank, we can't forget about that or get away from that. That always has to be part and parcel with whatever we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could stack something on top of it, but the basic level, it's got to be reliable layer two and layer three connectivity, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, resilient, exactly. Reliable.
Resilient. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, 100%. In fact, I'm reminded of this when I'm in the process of switching home firewalls and all of the names withheld to protect the guilty, but I'm missing features and detail and the ability to get data to understand what's going on, because everybody's obfuscating it, trying to make it easier to look at. And yet all I want is like somebody give me a freaking syslog of like all of the freak, like I want to turn debug mode on. Yeah. So yes, definitely. I love the advice. Yeah. Don't forget about the basics, what it's really there for.
Yeah.
Albert, we thank you so much. Enjoy your off ramp.
Or enjoy your on ramp.
Right.
Cause it's an on ramp potentially to something else, right?
Yeah. There you go. That's true too. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time.
Albert, it's been a pleasure.
No, it's been a lot of fun. This is the second podcast I've ever done, and it's nice. I mean, you guys make it easy, so congratulations. And right on.